When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm senior producer Connor Boyle. As the war in Ukraine continues, today we hear from Mikhail Zigar, renowned Russian dissident and journalist who speaks about how misinformation and propaganda has helped sow the seeds for Russia's invasion of its neighbor. It's the topic of his recent book, which is War and Punishment, Putin, Zelensky, and the Path to Russia's Invasion of Ukraine. In conversation with Zigar is Edward Lucas, columnist at The Times and an expert in national security. If you'd like to hear this episode ad-free and enjoy the full-length version, you can support our mission to foster honest debate and compelling conversation by heading to intelligencesquared.com/membership or subscribing to our channel via Apple. Now let's join Edward Lucas and Mikhail Zigar in conversation.
I'm Edward Lucas. Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm delighted to introduce our guest today, Mikhail Zigar. He's a writer, journalist, filmmaker. He worked for Newsweek Russia and Kommersant, the Business Daily. He's a foreign correspondent covering conflicts in the Middle East, Iraq, Serbia, and Kosovo. And he was also the founding editor-in-chief of Russia's, at the time, only independent news channel, Dozhd, which was a big alternative to the Kremlin propaganda machine, and now, of course, is in exile. Mikhail won the International Press Freedom Award in 2014. He's the author of several books, including All the Kremlin's Men, which was a number one bestseller in Russia, available in English. And his new book is War and Punishment, Putin, Zelensky, and the Path to Russia's Invasion of Ukraine. Mikhail, thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, Ed. Thank you for having me. That's a huge honor for me.
Great. What I love about your book is its historical scope. I mean, it goes right back to the days of Kievan Rus, and we will talk about that in a moment. But the thing that really caught me caught my attention at the beginning is it's a kind of, not exactly a love letter, but a sort of apology letter to your friend Nadia in Kiev. And you used to go and stay with Nadia whenever you were there. And you say very sadly that she doesn't talk to you anymore because she thinks you're an imperialist. And in a way, your book is a kind of attack on Russian imperialism. And I suppose it, in a way, also sort of an apology to Nadia. Has she read the book?
I don't know. You know, the book has just been released in English. And I'm not sure if it's going to be released in Russian or in Ukrainian within the upcoming months, at least. So I have no idea if she has heard about this book, but I hope that she will, and I hope that many Ukrainians will read this book as well. I don't mean that this book is written for the Ukrainians, because Ukrainians have a lot of brilliant authors who have written a lot of very important books on Ukrainian history. This book is not Ukrainian history. That's a history of Russia and Russian imperialism. But I guess that this approach to the Russian history would be very important for Ukrainian audience as well as for the Russians.
Yes. It's interesting. I have many Ukrainian friends who just say they're profoundly uninterested in anything the Russians have to say right now. There's a kind of feeling that it's time for the Russians just to shut up, whether they're Kremlin Russians or what they call liberal imperialist Russians. It's all pretty much the same thing. And we'll get onto that in a a bit later on in the discussion. But I want to really kick off by introducing your book to the audience, and you break it into two parts. There's seven tales of colonial oppression in Ukraine, starting with the sort of appropriation of Kievan Rus by Russia, and ending up with the appropriation of the World War II story from a Russian imperialist point of view. And then you follow that up with seven tales of present-day oppression in Ukraine, starting with the way in which Ukraine struggled against Soviet rule in that era, and ending up with what you call how Volodymyr Zelensky stopped joking. So tell me why did you decide to do it this way, this sort of first the distant past and then the more recent past?
First, I think that the distant past is very important, because unfortunately history is very much alive, and historical mythology is being always used to explain the current political situation, to justify the war. Unfortunately, Russia doesn't have any proper history, although it has always had a bunch of historical myths, war propaganda, propagandist myths, which were used for the benefit of the power. Right after the war started, I felt some kind of moral obligation to try to destroy traditional historical narrative, imperialist historical narrative of Russia. And I think that it was such a shock to convince a lot of people that we need to de-imperialize our history, and we need to start writing it from the scratch, because most of traditional Russian historians were imperialistic propagandists. So this book is probably my first step in the long way to try to debunk the imperial myths. I've got seven most important myths about Russia and Ukraine that I don't think that my work is done with this book.
Indeed. Well, you start off your introduction by saying that it's a confession, and you say that Russian writers and historians are complicit in facilitating this war, and it's their words and thoughts over the past 350 years that sowed the seeds of Russian fascism and allowed it to flourish. You say we failed to spot how deadly the idea of Russia as a great empire was, and we overlooked the fact that for many centuries the, quote, great Russian culture belittled other countries and peoples and suppressed and destroyed them. And then you go on to these seven myths, which have proved so deadly today. Now, we don't have time to go through every bit of the first seven or the second seven, so we'll have to pick out a few. And I want to say to people who are watching and listening online that we'll be talking for about another half hour, and for the final 20 minutes of this, you'll have a chance to put your questions. So if you feel I've missed something out, you can jump in and highlight that, and I'll be particularly happy to have thoughts from any Ukrainians who are listening. But I suppose that it all starts off with this idea that Kievan Rus is somehow something to do with modern Russia, and that is something that Putin believes absolutely profoundly, that Ukrainians have appropriated something that's profoundly Russian. Whereas, of course, from a Ukrainian point of view, it's exactly the other way around, that Rus has nothing to do with Russia, and that the true heir of the ancient Rus is modern Ukraine. So for those who haven't followed these important events of 350 years ago so closely, just talk us through the first of your myths, the myth of unity.
Actually, I don't start with Kievan Rus. I start with much more recent, much closer past, with the so-called mythical reunification, so-called reunification of Russia and Ukraine, an infamous treaty between the Tsardom of Moscow and Cossack Hetmanate. the contract signed between Tsar Alexis and Bohdan Khmelnytsky. And it's really important that it was perceived in a very different way by different parts. For Cossacks, it was just a contract signed between two equal parts. But Tsar of Moscow did not get that idea of a contract, how he could sign any contract with anyone. So for him, that was just a pledge. And that was the beginning of all the miscomprehensions between the Russian authoritarian power and Ukrainians.
Yes, but I think the point is that to have the myth of reunification, you have to have the myth of unity at the beginning. And you go through this you then follow it up with the story of Ivan Mazepa and his row with Peter the Great, and then Catherine the Great's tussles with the Cossacks, from which we see how conflictual this relationship was. And of course, from the Russian point of view, they see the Ukrainians as sort of disobedient little brothers who go off and do things like making alliances with the Swedes that ends in disaster. Whereas from the Ukrainian point of view, it's really quite different. But let's get on to the question of language, because this is something that is at the heart of the war now and of Russia's imperialist attitude to Ukraine. But it has very deep roots. For those viewers to this discussion who aren't familiar with it, talk us through the story of Taras Shevchenko and how he battled slavery, which you call the myth of language.
That's very important, and symbolic figure for Ukrainian history. That proves that Ukrainian language was not, as Russian imperialists usually say, a deviation of Russian or some wrong Russian language. And Ukrainians were speaking Ukrainian language for centuries. And that's probably an important difference between, let's say, Austrian Empire and Russian Empire. They had very different perception of ethnic minorities. For example, Ukrainians who lived in Austrian Empire, they were from the start considered to be second-class citizens, and they could not reach the higher classes. They didn't have opportunity to become the part of the political elite. But at the same time, there was no discrimination in terms of language. They could speak Ukrainian language. At the same time, in Russia, everything was very much different. Ukrainians could become part of privileged Russian society with only one condition: if they abandoned their Ukrainian background and if they spoke only Russian. And there are a lot of examples of ministers, chancellors of Ukrainian background who stopped speaking Ukrainian, who started speaking Russian, and that's very important because Russian Empire was being built as a political nation. Anyone could have become Russian, abandoning his or her own culture and starting speaking Russian. So that's why probably the Russian language and Russian culture bears additional responsibility for the crimes of the Russian Empire.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Yes, it's interesting how language has become a political category. There's this phrase in Russian of Russian speakers, and we saw this already in the very early 90s with a man called Sergei Karaganov came up with something called the Karaganov Doctrine, which elevated the Russian speakers to a political category and said that the Kremlin had the right and indeed the duty to intervene in other countries on behalf of Russian speakers. And the people at the time who thought that this was as sinister as creating German speaker as a political category. And we know how that ended in Europe in the 30s. But people were very unwilling then in that era to accept that this sort of linguistic ethno-nationalism, if one can call it that, was sinister. But of course, it comes back now very, very clearly. In Putin's distaste and the Putin propaganda machine's sort of idea that the Ukrainian language is something that is so sinister, it has to be eradicated. And it's sort of quite extraordinary, sort of exterminationist rhetoric, which comes up. I was wondering, when you were in Ukraine, you did a lot of reporting there, and you've interviewed many of the leading figures of Ukrainian political and public life in the last 30 years. Did you learn any Ukrainian yourself?
I understand Ukrainian perfectly, because every time participating in a political talk show in Ukraine, Ukrainian television has always been very politicized, and the focus on political talk shows was enormous. And average political talk show lasted for 4 hours, and it has always been a mixture of languages. Several guests used to speak Russian, sometimes even the presenters, but majority was speaking Ukrainian, and it was okay for everyone talking in two different languages at the same time. So it was a very long school for me, and every now and then coming to Kyiv, I always was going to Ukrainian theaters and then cinema theaters, watching a lot in Ukrainian. So I, for me, it's very easy to read Ukrainian books and to listen to Ukrainians. So I'm not an active speaker, but I think that I know Ukrainian language very well, and I know all the differences. I can read Shevchenko in his original.
Yes, it's very interesting you say that, because when I lived in the Soviet Union, I was very struck by the kind of profound asymmetry that everyone in the Soviet Union spoke Russian, but almost no Russians spoke anything other than Russian. So you always had to, and it had echoes to me of and perhaps the British presence in India, where if you wanted to get on.
That's the same as with British Empire, and yeah.
Yes,
many people speak English. Do not feel obliged to speak other languages, unfortunately.
Yes. So we're going to fast forward a bit to the you touch on one of the other myths, which is which Putin has said quite recently, that Ukraine is just a creation of Lenin and the result of the territorial division of the Tsarist Empire following the Bolshevik Revolution. And we could have a whole an hour's discussion on that, and with all the interesting literary and historical aspects, such as Bulgakov's great novel, The White Guard. But I think we can't do do justice to anything involved in Russia and Ukraine.
I think that's just pathetic. That idea that Lenin invented Ukraine is ridiculous.
But I think we have to spend a few minutes on the hunger genocide, the Holodomor, which is probably the defining event of the century, of the past century for Ukraine, and is even more traumatic and catastrophic than the events following 1917. And it's become now a very important part of Ukrainian historiography, but not so much of Russian. And of course, then followed on by the Stalin Great Terror. What would you say? What's the myth about the Holodomor in Russia that you're trying to attack?
It's very interesting that Russian historians, as well as Russian journalists, usually justify some crimes by telling that was normal. That was normal situation. It happened to everyone. As if now they are comparing the aggression against Ukraine, Russian aggression against Ukraine, to the American war in Iraq, saying that, okay, they did it, why cannot we do the same? You know, they use terrible crimes of others to justify their own crimes, or when speaking about Holodomor, the usual explanation is there was a huge famine everywhere. There was famine in Ukraine, but also in Volgograd region and also in Kazakhstan. So there was nothing extraordinary about that. Yeah, everyone was dying, and that's a huge mistake. That's famine in Kazakhstan does not explain and does not justify the great crime of Stalin's regime in Ukraine. And Holodomor in Ukraine obviously was organized and pre-orchestrated by Stalin because of his hatred towards Ukrainians, because he didn't trust Ukrainians. And it was not only about the Great Famine, it was also the huge attack against Ukrainian culture. And no Russian usually is aware of such a tragedy of Ukrainian nation as executed Renaissance. The greatest poets, writers, philosophers of Ukrainian nation were arrested, executed, sent to Gulag, and that happened at the same time when most Ukrainian villagers were dying out of hunger. So that was not just a part of the full picture. That was an organized campaign against Ukraine, and it's really needed to understand that for many Russians as well as for the international audience.
I want to just touch briefly now on the question of Stepan Bandera, because it's interesting how this brings together two of the great sort of Russian sort of Putin era propaganda tropes. One is the absolute centrality of the cult of victory in 1945, that Russia is the inheritor of Soviet heroism and the glory of the defeat of the Third Reich, and that anyone who disputes this is therefore ipso facto a Nazi. And that, and then the second great thing is that the Ukrainians are ungrateful and rebellious, and Bandera, who was at least a part of the war, a Nazi collaborator, though also later on a Nazi, a prisoner of the Nazis, the leader of the Ukrainian nationalist insurrection, is a lightning rod for both of those. But it's still something that troubles many outsiders when they look at Ukraine. They say, yes, we support Ukraine in their struggle against Russians, but why torchlight processions for Bandera, who is tarred with anti-Semitism and with many other, and also the massacre of Poles in Volhynia. So for many Russians who basically support Ukraine, Bandera is a very serious sticking point. Explain what's your treatment of Bandera, both in terms of his wartime activities and his role in Ukraine now?
I think that history should not be very simplistic. It has always been very complicated, and all those details are important. If someone calls Bandera to be Nazi collaborator, he's not more Nazi collaborator than Stalin, because Bandera stopped any cooperation with the Nazi regime, right, accidentally, but right after German invasion of the Soviet Union, because he and his supporters of Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists proclaimed independent Ukraine, and that was something Hitler did not anticipate and didn't want. So Bandera was sent to the concentration camp and spent most of the World War II in the concentration camp. And Bandera's idea and Bandera's only goal was to establish independent Ukraine. And he was very, very principled in those terms. Okay, and if we compare, to explain that to a broader audience, we might remember that many leaders of Indian independence movement during World War II were also supportive of Hitler, not because they were Nazis, but because they were against the British Empire. So yes, Bandera was against Soviet Empire, and that was the top priority for him. And yes, for Ukraine today, Bandera is at the same time very symbolic, at the same time very divisive figure. But I think the current war has made a lot to accept that figure, because now we have Putin as the real fascist, as the real Nazi, and we have seen the real evil as Russian aggression against Ukraine, and that makes most of the decisions made by Stepan Bandera very much understandable.
I want to whiz on to the man you describe as the most popular politician in the world, Volodymyr Zelensky, and you chart his rise first in the world of television showbiz and then into politics. But you draw a very interesting point, which I want to bring out, which is that the roots of his approach to television lie in a Soviet era program, which is really quite hard to describe. It was the club of the sort of the cheerful and go-getters, and it's very hard to explain to an English speaking audience. It was the most popular program in the Soviet Union. Watched it many times.
Championship for stand up comedians. Stand up comedians.
Talk us through this, because the sort of Russian-Ukrainian culture and memory wars were played out sometimes in skits on the where different teams from different parts of the Soviet Union would sort of compete to satirize the news, and then it was and it's that program really which was a sort of the roots of Zelensky's own comedy programs, which made him rich and famous in Ukraine even before he became president.
For me, it was very important to tell that story and to show how the humor was changing, because it shows very clearly the trajectory and the trend, how the mentality of Ukrainian society and Russian society was changing after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and that the jokes that seemed to be appropriate in early 90s have become terribly insulting during the last decade, and the two societies of two different countries have changed a lot. But it's also very important that that Vladimir Zelensky himself was changing, and he started as a just pure stand-up comedian, and his sense of humor has become very politicized. And it has become a very important factor For example, in 2014, when he made a sketch about Vladimir Putin and his supposedly mistress, Alina Kabaeva, and Zelensky himself was playing the role of Alina Kabaeva. And that was probably the first moment when Vladimir Putin heard of Zelensky. And so the first thing he knew about the new president of Ukraine, or definitely presidential candidate, he knew that that's the guy who played Alina Kabaeva. So that was a huge insult for Vladimir Putin from the beginning, something that he could never tolerate and forgive.
You also bring out the very strong streak of what one might call anti-Ukrainian racism in both the Soviet and Russian discourse. I was very struck by the fact you dug out something which I remember from 1991, I think it was, which was the final New Year's program of the last year of the Soviet Union, when they didn't quite know who was going to conduct give the sort of the New Year's toast, because Yeltsin was politely indisposed in one direction and Gorbachev was already out. And a comedian who I think was called Zadornov had a sort of string of really unpleasant anti-Ukrainian jokes. And this is something that has been a hallmark of Russian discourse since then, the idea that Ukrainians are sort of hicks or rednecks or sort of basically stupid. And I've always been very struck by how few Russians were willing to call that out. It seemed to be sort of the only acceptable, Russians who would be ashamed to make jokes about Jews or black people were quite happy to make jokes about Ukrainians.
I think that we've come a long way. And somehow in early 90s and even in during the late the last years of the Soviet Union, there was an idea that Russians are the people who are suffering the most. They bear all the responsibility and they pay all the costs of living in the Soviet Union, and they kind of pay for everyone. They work for everyone. They supply everyone. They feed everyone, and they are very offended for because all other nationalities want to leave Soviet Union. So that idea that Russian people were betrayed by Lithuanians, Georgians, Ukrainians, Kazakhs, and so on was very popular, and was something a lot of people felt in early 90s and later on after the collapse of the Soviet Union. It's really strange. It's really weird. That's the product of the post-Soviet propaganda, and that's the source of that weird mindset shared by Vladimir Putin as well as many Russians.
And I think you're absolutely right that there's an odd equivalence between this sort of Russian solipsism, it's all about us, and the Orientalist approach in the West, which thinks that it's all really about Russia. And one of the things that I noticed during the Cold War and then in the 90s and the noughties was how enormously Russian-focused all our supposedly Slavic studies or Soviet studies were. And although it was on paper, 15 so-called republics of the Soviet Union and many other countries which have Slavic languages, in the end, there was an enormous sort of discourse hegemony and epistemic privilege, to use the sort of jargon words, for the Russian language and Russian literature. But I just want to get a little bit more on contemporary Ukraine before we might circle back to that in the questions. But you have several examples of in your what you call the present day, and one is the very striking anti-Ukrainian prejudice from Joseph Brodsky, who for many people, me included, is one of the great heroes of the Soviet dissident movement. And we read with tears in our eyes his lonely duel with the prosecutor when he's on trial in St. Petersburg in the Leningrad, and is asked, "Who gave you the authorization to be a poet?" And yet his poem on Ukrainian independence is from 1992, I think, is absolutely disgusting. He says the you're going to be gang raped, and the Krauts and the Poles, the Polacks, are going to gang rape the crap out of you. And it's this astonishingly nasty poem. And of course, that's echoed by, I mean, from way back by Pushkin's anti-Polish poetry, but also to some extent by Solzhenitsyn's rather more gently expressed attitude to Ukraine. So just talk us through this sort of strand in, even among the greats of Russian culture, the sort of inability to get Ukraine as a place and Ukrainians as a people.
You know, I think that's even broader question. We need to address all the mistakes and all the sins of Russian culture. And we cannot pretend that they were saints, they were always right, they taught us humanism, and that's it. That would be fair. Yes, Russian history was very imperialist. Yes, a lot of great figures considered to be great Russian writers, great Russian poets, were human beings, and some of them wrote terrible things. And we don't need to hide. We should not hide it. We should not judge them. We should not discuss all those issues as other cultures did. Was Kipling canceled for his poem about white man's burden? That was a terribly racist. And he was not the only one to express racist ideas. A lot of Russian writers, for example, Dostoevsky was terrible Russian nationalist, and he considered Turkey to be a nation that didn't have a right to exist. He wanted Constantinople to become the capital of Russia. A lot of values which were shared by different representatives of Russian culture were terrible, and we should discuss it. That's the issue that is often raised by Ukrainians today, by Russians today. A lot of representatives of current Russian cultural elite sometimes say, "Don't touch Pushkin; he's not to blame for Putin's crimes." Yeah, we should. We can't. We must not say don't touch anything. We should touch everything, and we should reconsider everything. If something was wrong, we should admit it. We should confess to ourselves. We should apologize. It's like there is no space for just forgetting something that was awkward or hideous.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Connor Boyle with editing from Tom Hall. If you'd like to hear the full extended version right now, then head over to intelligencesquared.com to sign up and become a member. We'd also love to hear your feedback and what you think we should be talking about next. Send us an email or a voice note with your thoughts to podcasts@intelligencesquared.com. And if you'd like to hear more, attend some of our live events, or peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds, then head over to intelligencesquared.com.